Accession number 11939, rule 18.
Mr. J. L. Williams, Reel 18. Before we leave Tunisia, Mr. Williams, is there anything that you wish to raise on any highlights in that campaign?
Yes, well, being a commissioned officer of the Dermot Infantry, I should really have mentioned that at the beginning of January, just after New Year's Day, 1943, we were relieved up on the Northern Front, in front of Green Hill and Bald Hill, by the 16th Battalion of the Durham Light Infantry. They took over us when it was dark, and it was a little bit touching to hear the Geordie voices of my own regiment, and I heard one officer speak, and I recognised his voice. He was a bloke called Bill Duck, who'd been at Octi with me, and I said, "Is that you, Bill?" "Oh," he said, "I'm so glad to hear your voice." He said, "I'm in a hell of a state. It's the first time I've been so near the enemy. And to hear a voice that I know," he said, "you've no idea how fine it is." I said, "Well, keep your head down, boy. They're a bit higher than you, but if you keep your head down and use your loaf, and not in no necessary moment, you'll be all right while you're getting acclimatized." I understand that shortly after that, he was killed. And then when Jerry made a push and pushed the Durham Light Infantry back along the road through Sechenin and Tamera and back to Jebel Abiod, we were sent up, the Royal West Kents were sent up, and we arrived there just before, an hour or so before it got dark, and the CO got hold of me and he said, "Look, it's your old battalion regiment, Jack. They've had a bit of a hiding, and they really need to be relieved. We can't do it, a complete relief tonight. Will you go up and put a screen round them?" He said, "I'm asking you particularly because you're a Durham Light Infantry officer." So I said, "Yes." I said, "Yes, sir." So we went up the hill, took my carriers up to a point, got my men out, put a screen along a ridge where there was a bitterly cold wind blowing, put a screen out, started patrols going. I then went and asked where the CO's headquarters was, and he was in a sort of a cave a little bit further back, and it was Colonel Preston of the King's Own Yorkshire Light Infantry who was commanding the 16th Battalion. And I said to him, "Sir, you can take your boots off if you wish and have a sleep. We've got a good screen round you. And I'm additionally pleased to tell you that I'm also an officer of the Durham Light Infantry." "Oh, hell," he said, sit down. And I had a little drop of rum with him. And he asked me how I was with the Royal West Kents. And I explained to him. He said, "Well, look, I'm short of a hell of a lot of officers. Would you like to come back and take a company?" I said, "Well, I'm going to say something, sir. It's probably sounds strange to you. But I've got so used to my Cockneys and Kentish lads that if I'm going to be in battle, I think I'll stay with them." He said, "Well, don't forget, old boy, if ever you want to come back, you may do so. Just let me know."
Is this a screen of your own mortar platoon?
I had my mortar platoon and one or two other men, which I'd taken them on my carrier, and put them round. I put the mortars in a position with, and then used my men, and I was taking patrols along a ridge and back all night, just to make sure that we were covered, because there were only two approaches. There was a track round there and there was a ridge here where we had, and I covered them all until dawn the following day when our battalion took over from them. I was then pushed further forward. And the other interesting thing, which has nothing to do with battle, but then there was a big open cast, mining sort of area, which I took over, and I was looking after the lip. I had my mortars there, that's all it was. And a staff officer spoke to me before I went up and said, "Look, we're changing the guns around, ready for an attack. If the enemy come, don't engage them until they get almost hand to hand. And whatever you do, if you can possibly afford it, don't call for any SOS fire from the guns. Otherwise, we'll unmask our positions." And that happened. The Germans got very near. They took machine guns off. I heard the German officer giving a good bollocking to one of his men because he dropped the gun barrel in his nervousness. They sprayed all around us and we lay still and took nothing about it. And there was an old Frenchman living in a house in this big quarry. And I asked him where it was. And it was an iron ore mine. Purple ore, that's hematite iron ore. One of the last things I did before I left Considine Company was to receive a delivery of ore from that particular mine. I thought it was a deep mine, it turned out to be an open cast iron ore mine. So there was another link, you know.
What area of Tunisia was this?
This was just in the hills in front of Jebel Abiod on the northern front. The line ran back, the road ran back from Matur, down to Jeffna Station, Sejanein, Tamera, and down to Jebel Abiod, which was the next biggest town. It was the northern front line. At the end of the Tunisian campaign, while a heavy fight, I'm saying this, I don't mean to say this in a derogatory fashion, while the heavy fighting was going on for Tunis in the Majorda Valley, the Yanks went across and took this attack up here and took Matur.
What period of time was this that you were in that area?
Well, now, it must have been when we were coming back from the Rabah area, you know, it was because Jerry really pushed the 16th Battalion back, you know. I was talking to one of the 16th men who told me that they were in a ditch on the side of the road and the Germans were coming advancing. They obviously must have been, had been given some, used to get red wine and sort of red biddy, the Germans, where we got rum, you know. And he said, these Germans with distinctive Geordie voices were shouting, come out, Geordie, and fight. You're supposed to be bloody soldiers. So he said, well, let them get right past us. And we did come out with our bayonets. He said, they're a bit sorry that they talk like that. But that's by the way. And the only other thing I think worth mentioning is that after the, immediately after Tunis was taken, the Bey of Tunis, who was the local king, if you like, of Tunis, had been consorting with the Germans. And he was to be deposed. And I suddenly was whipped up by the show. Again, I think it was not because of anything superior on my part. I could speak a bit of French, and I had carriers. There was this palace in Sidi Bou Said, and this was just outside Tunis, between Tunis and Carthage. And the they said there were fanatical Muslim troops. His bodyguard were all gathered around there. And the people were inside deposing the bay. And I had to go up and place some machine guns and the odd mortar in strategic positions. And the slightest sign of any trouble, open up. Because the fanatical Muslim troops had sort of blue jackets on with tarbush, you know, the Turkish sword type, with a long tassel hanging nearly down to the back of their waist and wide gaiters and so on. And I put my first lot in position. I told them to stay and told my blokes exactly what to do. Then I took a carry and went round here to another gate, put them in position, and round to that gate and round to that gate. And when I came back, the fanatical Muslim troops had leaned their ass up against the wall and were coming along mooching cigarettes from my blokes. I said, well, just watch them. And I was standing against the wall, the place, this is my headquarters, and there was a huge billowing mass of jasmine hanging down outside this house. And I was smelling it, and suddenly an Arab appeared, a very tall, commanding sort of figure, with a beautiful silk jalab and thing. And he spoke to me in French, and he said, you like jasmine, mon lieutenant? Jasmine? Oui, monsieur, I said. He clapped his hands, he approved that, and out came a girl, cut a great big bunch, and there I was standing in my carrier, ready to do battle with fanatical Muslims, with a great bunch of jasmine. And I put it down, and he talked to me, that man, and he said, we do not like the French. Is there any possibility of our being incorporated in the British Empire? And I said, well, sir, I'm a very junior officer of a fighting regiment. I have nothing whatever to do with politics or anything of that nature. Said, nevertheless, mon lieutenant, if you get the opportunity, will you tell your seniors that I and my friends would be very glad to join the British Empire? I said, I certainly shall, and thank you for the jasmine. And that's a Tunisia.
Next move would be the Sicily invasion.
That's right, yes.
Where did you go in with the invasion force?
We went on the flank, just about follow up. I had had trouble with when we were in North Africa, I had trouble with a bit of bone plugging in my nose, and I took the opportunity to go to hospital, get it drilled out. And when I was in hospital, we knew there was something going to happen. Everybody, all the officers knew that it was going to be the 10th of July, and it was getting near. So I went to the officer. I had my, this nose all plugged up, and I went to the surgeon who'd done it. I said, "Look, sir, could I get back to my unit?" He said, "You bloody well stay here, you can go." He said, you don't want any septic in trouble, that." And I waited a bit more. And then the CO came up to see me, supposed to be the 10th. He also brought a note from my wife's sister to say that our firstborn son, my wife had been giving birth in a hospital in Kent. And while the child was half born, the germs had bombed and set fire to the hospital. My wife had been dragged down in the trouble down to the basement. To complete the birth, the child died after 2 days. At the same time, I didn't get much chance to worry, because also there was one of my blokes in hospital at the time, and the CEO said, "I've got to see him. Will you come with me, Jack?" His wife and mother-in-law had been killed by a German bomb in Kent, so that took a little bit of the sting out of my worries. Well, I went and sat with this lad. Anyhow, I went a second time to see if I could be discharged, and I got sent back and said, "Man, you bloody well wait till I tell you." So the next day, I got all my kit on, got my kit, and went up and said, "Are you going to discharge me, sir, or do you want me to commit a military offence?" He said, "Sister, give this bloody stupid officer his discharge." So I went out talking with this big block up my nose, getting into advance. I was creeping up the hill in Tunisia just after we landed, and a shell burst, and I snorted with fear, and my plug flew out, and I never had any more trouble with it.
This was in Sicily.
This was in Sicily. But anyhow, we went on landing ship tanks, because I had not the ordinary landing craft for the troops, because I had carriers and so on, you know. And of course, when you were going on a landing like that, you had to make watertight. You took the exhaust pipe, you took to an extension above the height of where it was, and all the working parts you covered over with waterproofing and so on. So one of the
first kind of waterproofing did you use?
It was yellow. It was a yellow sort of tape which went all, which meant it run the engine for about 3 minutes and it would blow up. So the first thing you did, no matter what opposition there was, you had to get the waterproofing off. And we landed, but we landed in a quiet part. I remember the first thing, ran up the small beach, right under one of these, dried fruit things, you know, carob tree, you know. And I was standing eating carobs from the tree while my driver took the waterproofing off, you know. And then we moved forward and began to engage the enemy. Now, we were given a job. We were up against very, very determined paratroops. I believe I told you when I was in Africa, I had not ever felt really afraid. Well, I don't know whether it was fear or what, but bad job, I was on edge all the time with these paratroops. We had to go around. We started on the west of Etna, the big mountain, you know, about 12,000 feet high, the volcano, and go through the hills around, right round the northern side. General Patton and his gang had landed way back, and they were coming along the northern road, well behind us. There was a little bit of hold up, but not much, because once we got started along here, we could hear the American guns firing at scattering the Germans, but we had all this lot. And we went to a place called Centuripe, Centuripe. Now, once again, these blasted journalists said, I saw a report where they said, the troops called it Cherry Ripe. Now, I never heard any soldier in the British Army refer to Centuripe as Cherry Ripe. But it was one of these journalists' fantasies, you know. And it had been well and truly bombed. And there were all these hills, and we had to fight our way through the town, completely in ruins, very much like Cassino was later on. And we had attacked, and there was a hill just outside the town as we were going up, and Jerry held on there, and I had lost all my mules going through the town.
Killed.
Except one. And I got my blokes to unload a dead mule, and we could not make way through the ruins. it was dark, you see, we were going up from that time. And so I said, right, come back, we'll start again and get some more mules. And when I got down, the brigadier was there, Swifty Howlett. I said, I'm sorry, sir, I've lost every bloody mule, and I need some more mules to go and get forward. He said, now, Williams, you don't mean that my battalion, because he used to command the 6th Battalion, you don't mean my battalion, I've got no bloody mortar support. I said, I mean just that, sir. He said, well, you bloody well get going. I said, I will bloody well get going if you'll give me some more mules. And there was a staff officer there, said, it's all right, Williams, old boy. We know precisely what it is. Don't you worry. I thought Swifty was suggesting that I was backing out, you see. And Swifty apologised to me later. And I got some more mules and had to go up in daylight. The shells and mortars were raining down on me. And we got up, and the battalion were all lined up for an attack. And I hadn't any target to go at. And the show was lying on a bit of ground just advanced. And there was a tank just round the corner. And the second in command said, slip up and tell the CO you're around. And I crept up beside the CO. Oh, he said, I'm glad you made it, Jack. He said, I haven't got a target for you here. But he said, just stay here. And he said, he looked at his watch, he said, right, we're just going to go. Slip down that hillside there and tell that tank officer that we're going to move off. So I went down, and then I stayed behind there, and the shells were raining down. My mules were in a bit of a hollow. I had one mule fastened to a tree, and the mule and the tree went away up in the air together. And when I was lying there, there was another, one of my good friends of one of the rifle companies who always used to say, when I said, I'll send two up, my mortars up here and two there, and I'll go with me. That's to say, with a D company, you know, because that was my, he was a regular officer. And we were there, and our blokes hardly started out till they were actually being mown down. And so this other officer and I, called Ian Roper, Ian said, come on, Jack, we'll get some of these wounded in. So we were creeping around, trying to get some of the wounded in. There was one bloke lying, I always remember, and he was cursing furiously, most bad language, and he was on his face, and he had a tremendous hole in his back. And I took his field dressing and put it in the hole in his back. I said, now lie still, I'll get you away as soon as I can. He said, oh, I bloody well had it, sir. These effing Germans have done me at last. He said, I did want to kill a few more of that bastard before I went. And I took my field dressing, put in, and I was lying on him because neither of us could move, with my knee holding two field dressings in the hole of his back, and the blood was still welling around. Right? And he lay there, and he died. I had to leave him. And we got one or two other men in, and then the CO signaled that Jerry was up out of the hill, and we went up with our mortars and got in position. I was looking round the outside, but the Germans were literally staying all the time. Behind rocks, you know, the first-class fighting men. And we had a lot of casualties there.
What time was it? Time of the year was this?
Mid-July, you know, and beginning of August. And then from there we went on to a place called Bromty, which figures in history because after the Battle of Trafalgar, Lord Nelson was made Duke of Bromty. So we went through Lord Nelson's estate. It was still his estate then, or his family's estate. And Jerry was using 6-barrel mortars, much bigger calibre than ours, and 6 howling sort of projectiles came through the air, bang, 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 you know. And I didn't use my mortars very much there. I was doing more of an infantry work with them, you know. I fired one or two. And
what was the terrain like that you were fighting over?
It was really lava, hills of lava, you know, because up there was Mount Etna. And there were great hills of lava and so on. It was really very, very hard. It was uphill all the way. And you're lying there on the lava, and you couldn't always get your water up and so on. You'd get sunburned from just lying face down against the lava, you know. You'd get your face burned.
So neither side would be able to dig in, or could
they? No, you could got behind rocks. You couldn't dig in, practically not at all. I remember I was creeping around behind some rocks to the flank to see whether I could get a mortar position, and I bumped into a Royal Artillery Sergeant. I said, good God, Sergeant, what are you doing creeping around among the infantry here? He said, well, I'm doing a little bit of echo spotting. I said, how do you do that? He said, well, I listen to the detonation of a German gun and take a bearing on it, then I creep 100 yards another direction, take a bearing on it, and send the 2 coordinates and hope that I've got. When I was talking to him, I said, turn around and look at me, Sergeant, will you? I said, I know you, you know me. We played on the Black Hill Junior's football team together. He was, he'd been training as a draftsman, as a sort of a draftsman and so on. His father was a local builder. I said, well, I've got to look around a bit further now, son. If you get out of this, write home and tell the people you've seen me, and I'll tell them I've seen you next time round. He was killed a little later, but not then, he was killed later on. So I never saw him again after that.
You left your carriers behind, obviously.
Yes, the carriers were blacked pretty well with the battalion headquarters. I was using mules to get through, you know.
And you're still a French drivers with the mules?
No. We had mules of our own. And back one stage, I requisitioned Italian peasants' mules, and those poor beasts were half-fed, you know. And they didn't have the strength of army mules. They never had proper meals and so on. And they were just collapsing. And I remember once there was one fell down on me, and I always used to like these mules, and I kneeled down and got its head on my knee, and I said, come on, old boy, see if you can make another bit for it. And it looked at me, and couldn't, you know. So I just patted it, and we took the motor. And the men had to carry, you see, when the mules were knocked down. But these poor mules, you know, it must have been hard, but to go into battle, and they have, they were carrying a 150 pounds, 75 pounds on each pannier. They just couldn't do it.
Did you get attached to the mules?
I used to, but I'm a bit attached to animals. I used to give them, I used to always give these animals my sweet ration out of my compo ration. You know, you got some sweets, boiled sweets. But I felt so sorry. I used to sometimes, in a strange sort of way, I used to curse that we were involving these poor bloody animals and had quarrels, you know.
What about feeding them whilst you were in action, or going into action and moving across country? How did you feed them?
Well, I had no food, and I used to just let them pull up the roadside. Any sort of this dried out old herbage and so on, bits of cactus stuff and so on. It was cruelty to animals, really. But we had no fodder for them and so on, you know. As usual, the British Army hadn't supplied us with mules in this particular case. When you had the Indian Army mules and so on, you were all later on in Italy, had Indian Army mules with Indian Sikh drivers and so on, and they were first-class beasts.
Was this because the Army hadn't realised that this was mule country?
Well, if they had, they hadn't supplied us. I think in the same category, when they used to send us into battle with no batteries for our radio sets and so on, you know, and that sort of thing. It was just some failure somewhere. And, of course, the thick-headed army man goes, well, we'll give these fellas carriers to carry them. What the hell do they want mules for, you know? And also, I don't think they could envisage this hard fighting around this terrible terrain in Tunisia. It was really, really heavy going.
And I assume that you drove the mules till they dropped?
Absolutely, yes. I try and get them to go on a little bit further. And then we did, thank God, because I meant, we did a long carry. I mean, I've carried a motorbike on my back as well, pour encourager les autres, you know, just to show the blokes that I could do it, they could do it, and that sort of thing. And the other thing there was, it was the mosquitoes were terrible. Men were having to take two Mepicrin tablets, you know, they were the anti-malarial tablets we had. And later on, we were making them chew them, you know, so that they made sure they absorbed them, because some of the lads were silly enough, because they were so bitter, and to spit them out after you'd given them. But when they chewed them up, they had to swallow them. And it was very, the Germans fought all the way back. The only Jerry's we saw were the dead ones who were left behind as they retreated. And then, as I said, it was a short period, but it was the most devastating, hard fighting we'd ever had. And I used my mortars on very, very few occasions. The other interesting thing was, we were going round Etna, on the north, you know, and the Americans were coming along the coast route, right from the west end of Sicily, across the top. And they were getting closer and closer because we could hear their guns. And then there was one place we tacked around, and we were narrowing, the whole division was narrowing to a point, and there was one city completely destroyed called Randazzo, R-A-N-D-A-Z-Z-O, on a hilltop. It had been a beautiful city, you know, the usual white sort of building, and they were just shattered. And we got there near the moonlight, and put an Irish patrol in as we moved up, and then suddenly there was no Germans in at all, but they pulled out. They disembarked, they were on the way, but the Irish were occupying. Suddenly word came through from different headquarters, leave the place quickly. This is supposed to be what the Americans are supposed to take this. So our people all backed off and the Yanks went there. The interesting was, and then we saw the American communique. After heavy fighting, American troops occupied Randazzo. Well, a three-year-old kid could have walked in because Jerry left it. There might have been a few mines there. But I mean, there's no heavy fighting that way, but it was one of these exaggerations of bulletins and so on, pour en courage les autres. And we got through up to the coast, and that was it. A short campaign, but very, 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 very hard and very, very painful. And I mean, no slit trenches. The shells and the mortars and the six-barrel mortars dropped on solid rock. And it was... How we all escaped, I don't know. But sometimes when there was a six-barrel mortar lot coming down, I tell you what, my face might have been buried in the dust, but my stomach was sticking off like that. And you're really panting, you know.
Was that the worst weapon to being under fire from?
Well, I can't say... Normally, the... I think it was the terrain. It couldn't penetrate the ground and blow up. It just hit rocks and burst sideways, you know. But it was a bit devastating. You heard the sixth battle motor go, whoo, 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 you know, and six bum, 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 like that. And you heard them coming through and whining through the air, you know. They weren't like our motors. They went up and just swished down. They came whining through the air. They should be about half-ton barrels, you know. It wasn't true, of course, but that's how it felt.
And did you see or witness troops, officers and men breaking under the stress of all this?
No, I didn't. None of my men did. If there were any in the companies, I don't know. But, you know, we were under very strict instructions that if we thought any of our... This year said one of the things we must avoid at all costs, if we've got some of these good lads who've done all the fighting... And he told us each place later on in Italy, good fighting in North Africa and Sicily, and their nerves have gone, and they're court-martialed for cowardice, I'll hold the officer responsible. Keep an eye on them. If you see them biting their fingers and wincing too much, send them back on a fictitious message. The quartermaster knows, you see. And that was... But none of my lot, I will say that. But it's a little bit unfair to say so, but... In battle, our blokes all had a job to do in the mortar platoon. This is a eulogy of the mortar platoon. And I was always round to see them and so on. And they never felt as though they were deserted. We had good sergeants and a good mortar sergeant, and I was with them all the time. I was never left out of battle. They knew that. And that was it.
But what was the biggest danger that a mortar platoon would have from the enemy side?
Well, there was a counter-mortar fire. The German mortars were of a longer range than ours, and machine gun fire, if we didn't get under cover quick enough. And then, of course, there were one or two cases where, later on in Italy, for example, we were left there and the enemy came on both sides of us. We were in danger of being overwhelmed. I'll come to that later, because I had an interesting time on one occasion. Again against paratroops. I don't know whether we were selected to fight paratroops or whether there can't have been all that many paratroops, but we've always seen in North Africa and in Sicily, we fought them all the time. I never saw any ordinary right through them. And they really fought well, those Germans, who were a credit to their training before they retired into Sicily, into Italy. And then we then went up on the coast, the Milazzo, this was after the Germans, Milazzo, and round that area it was where the famous Italian patriot Garibaldi had sailed from there to liberate Italy and make it a united Italy. That was a historical aspect there. And we were just resting then. As a matter of fact, this friend Ian, who I told you about, who we were collecting wounded in, met a friend who was in the Royal Air Force. So we got permission from Monsieur, and he and I went over for a couple of nights to Malta, in between this, before we did the Italian. And spent a couple of nights among the ruins and bombing in Malta and drinking stuff that tasted like turpentine and the mess, you know.
And what date did your campaign in Sicily finish?
Well, it must have been, it's difficult to say, it was towards the end of August, because we had a week or so there, and then I think it was September the 3rd when we crossed over the Messina, across the Straits of Messina, you know.